May the meditations of our hearts be acceptable to you, O Lord, our rock and redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. Our gospel lesson is a story that is one of the most important, tells of events, some of the most important events in Jesus' life. This is, when we look at it historically, this little story that we just read and that we'll look at a little more closely in a minute actually is a story that's shared by the other gospel writers. Remember, there are four writers of the gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tend to see things from the same perspective. Matthew and Luke borrow heavily from Mark. Mark is the first one to write a gospel, and so when Luke and Matthew came along a generation later, writing for their time and their place and their people, they built on Mark to explain who Jesus was and what his teachings were. Now, when John wrote this story, perhaps he borrowed it from Mark, perhaps he has his own sources, we just don't know. But it's clear that this event, which is so important, now occurs in all four Gospels. And when we look at it historically, we find that this passage that we just read is in the wrong place. Now, how can you say something in the Bible is in the wrong place? I mean, who are you? Well, I'm Gordon Schultz. What John has done, John has taken this story in all of its importance, has moved it from where Matthew, Mark, and Luke put it, on the last week of Jesus' life. As a matter of fact, most historians look at this story in Matthew, Mark, and Luke and say that what he did on that day is what sealed his fate. And that's the story that we're talking about. That Jesus' fate was sealed when he went into the temple. He'd come down from the north, from Galilee, come into Jerusalem, had a big demonstration, kind of a political demonstration on Palm Sunday, went in on Monday to teach in the temple, and crowds began to gather around him because of the authenticity and the power of his teaching. He then goes back to a place where the disciples are staying, and they come out again the next day. And it's this next day where Jesus, I don't know how to say it, goes on a rampage. He makes a whip of cords, as the text tells us, and he drives out the moneylenders. He drives out the cattle and the sheep and the doves and says, "Get out of here, you are ruining the house that God had us build." Now, why does John move it from the last week of Jesus' life, where it clearly belongs and where Matthew, Mark, and Luke really put it? John puts it at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, right at the beginning, an event that is sort of the end of his life, in a sense, in the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, gets moved to the beginning of John's story of Jesus. Why does he do that? He does that because he wants his readers to know that this is the character of Jesus' existence with the religious leaders of his time. That the religious leaders of his time are clearly in opposition to everything, not everything, but much of what Jesus stands for, much of what Jesus teaches, and much of what Jesus expects from his hearers. John is saying that Jesus faces conflict and confrontation from the beginning of his ministry, and does so by taking the story from the end of his life and moving it to the beginning. Now, a little more background is necessary to understand what's going on here. And the background goes like this. John writes this about 50 years after the events took place. These events took place. And in between that time, the most terrible cataclysm took place since for 600 years. That is, the Romans, the Jewish sect called the Zealots began, they started an uprising. And it was one thing to start an uprising against Syrians 500 years ago. It was a very different thing to start an uprising against the might of Rome. and the response of the Roman army and the response of Caesar was destroy them. Now, Caesar had his fill of putting up with the Jews in Rome and the Jews back in Jerusalem because they were demanding that they be allowed certain privileges and certain freedoms and that their religion not be contravened. And probably, I don't know if there's any group in the history of the world that has been more fractious and more determined to protect their religion than the ancient Jews were. And they would go to their grave fighting to keep their land and their religion pure. And that's in fact what happened. Vespasian, the general and later Caesar, brought his forces into Jerusalem and around Jerusalem, and it's estimated that 1 million people were slaughtered during that time. But that's not all. As bad as that is, something for most Jews was even worse. Something that happened was even worse, and that is the temple was destroyed. Now, what's a temple? It's a building, right? I mean, it's just a building, and they have a kind of funny relationship with it because these Pharisees said, come on, we've been building this thing for 46 years and it's still not done, and I don't think it's ever going to get done, and you're going to break it down and rebuild it in 3 days? Mm-hmm. So the temple had a kind of importance in Israel that later generations simply couldn't understand. The temple was the beating heart of Israeli religion, Israeli society, Israeli politics. Israeli, not Israeli, I'm sorry, that's a modern slip. Israelite or Jewish realities. And everything revolved around the temple. There was no Judaism without the temple. There is no God. Because God lives in the temple. Without the temple, God's got no place to live. And what's going to happen to us if God is gone? And so try and imagine what it would be like to have the very heart, the very center of your faith to be completely destroyed. It's a way of saying God's got no power. Rome is greater than God. Where do we turn now? It's terrifying. And like so many peoples, when they face calamity, they turn on each other. And that's in fact exactly what happened. Various Jewish groups turned on each other, each one saying that you're the people responsible for Rome's destruction of the temple. And groups began to form, accusing each other of faithlessness and the failure to uphold the temple mount and the temple rituals. For most people, it just was a time of deep sadness and fear. Who and my family will be killed tonight? We've had no food for a month. How will we survive? And this group over here, they didn't fight with the zealots against Rome. Why not? They're supposed to be good Jews. Why aren't they fighting against the Roman Empire? And that group says, it's terrible the temple has been destroyed, but it's okay. We can live with this because Jesus Christ has been in our midst and who in fact predicted that the temple would be destroyed. And you know what? All of our existence as Jews has been based in the temple. And if the temple is gone, do we no longer have anything? And this other group says, no, God will not leave us bereft. God will not abandon us. God will not leave us to suffer alone. How is that? God's already been defeated by the Roman Empire. And so the battle is going back and forth between different groups of Jews. One group of Jews ends up becoming Rabbinic Judaism, which is the Judaism we have today, and Christians, who were the second set of Jews, and they became followers of Jesus. But they continued to fight. The most important thing in the world to them was at stake. How can we exist without the temple? How, which is another way of saying, how can we exist without a meeting place for God? The second set of Jews said, the meeting place for God doesn't have to be the temple. It's great when it's there. Jesus took advantage. Jesus went to the temple. The disciples went to the temple. They all did. Now, it's interesting that when we read the text, there's not a whole lot of temple talk in the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So it clearly was already beginning to lose some of its allure, some of its power, because it just doesn't appear very often in the Gospels. But it is there. We know that Jesus found worshiping the temple to be something very important, and he never said it should be destroyed. He predicted that it would because of the corruption of the land. We don't need the temple to have a meeting place with God. It's a radical notion. I mean, it turns Israelite theology upside down. We don't need the temple. How can you say that's like saying we don't need God? What they were trying to say, what they did say, is that God gave us the temple, and our corruption destroyed it, but God doesn't give up on us. God says there's another meeting place. Let me ask you, where is your meeting place with God? Is it in a beautiful cathedral that's sort of dark and mystical? Or is it in a sanctuary that's beautifully lit and strikingly modern and beautiful? Or is it in the great music of our faith, particularly of somebody like Bach, that just transcends and lifts us up to the presence of God in ways that nothing else can? Is your meeting place out in nature somewhere? Where is your meeting place with God? The text tells us, the Bible tells us, the New Testament tells us, John tells us that the meeting place that really counts, the holy place that really matters, is in us. God meets us where we are. We don't have to go and rebuild the temple. The temple has moved here. The temple is in us. Or no, a better way of saying it's not true. The temple is not in us. Jesus Christ is in us. And when Jesus Christ is in us, that's another way of saying a deeper, it's another way of saying that it is God who is with us. As Jesus stands in amidst our fellowship, God is present. Wherever Jesus is, God is present. Wherever you find a moment of transcendence, God is present. There is nothing we can do. There is no power that we have that can change this one reality. God is present for you, for me. Thanks be to God.